You should seek out Thunderhome, the fortress of my beloved Skadi. Tell her I sent you.
Your beloved? I asked. Aren't you divorced?
Yes.
But you're still friends.
I haven't seen her in centuries.
Niord got a distant look in his eyes.
And we didn't exactly part on good terms. But I have to believe she still holds some affection for me. Seek her out. If she grants you safe harbor for my sake, that will tell me she's forgiven me.
And if she doesn't welcome us? Harth asked.
That would be disappointing.
I took this to mean, you will all end up in Scotty's meat locker. I didn't like the idea of being my grandfather's test balloon for a reconciliation with his ex-wife. Then again, a potentially safe harbor sounded better than freezing to death in 20 seconds. Unfortunately, I got the feeling we hadn't heard Niord's worst helpful advice yet. I waited for the other shoe to drop, even though Niord did not appear to own any shoes. What's the second bit of wisdom? I asked. Niord's focus snapped back to me.
Oh, yes. The point of my story about my beautiful feet.
There was a point? Blitz sounded genuinely surprised.
Of course, Niord said. The most unexpected thing can be the key to victory. Baldur was the most handsome of the gods, but because of my feet, I won the girl.
Whom you later separated from and divorced, Blitz said.
Would you stop dwelling on that?
Niord rolled his eyes at me like dwarves these days.
My point, dear grandson, is that you will need to use unexpected means to defeat Loki. You began to realize that in Aegir's Hall, didn't you?
I didn't remember biting off any clumps of sea giantess hair, but a ball of the stuff seemed to be forming in my throat. Flighting, I said. I'll have to beat Loki in a contest of insults? New gray whiskers spread like frost through Niord's beard.
A flighting is much more than a series of simple put-downs, he warned. It's a duel of prestige, power, confidence. I was present at Aegir's Hall when Loki flighted with the gods. He shamed us so badly.
Niord seemed to deflate, as if just thinking about it made him older and weaker.
Words can be more lethal than blades, Magnus. And Loki is a master of words. To beat him, you must find your inner poet. Only one thing can give you a chance to beat Loki at his own game.
Mead, I guessed. Kvasir's mead. The answer didn't sit right with me. I'd been on the streets long enough to see how well mead improved people's skills. Pick your poison. Beer, wine, vodka, whiskey. Folks claimed they needed it to get through the day. They called it liquid courage. It made them funnier, smarter, more creative. Except it didn't. It just made them less able to tell how unfunny and stupid they were acting.
It's not merely mead, my grandfather said, reading my expression. Kvasir's mead is the most valuable elixir ever created. Finding it will not be easy.
He turned to Hearthstone and Blitzen.
You know this, don't you?
You know that the quest may claim both your lives.
Chapter 13. Stupid Exploding Grandfathers.
You should have led with that, I said, my pulse jackhammering in my neck. Hearth and Blitz do not die. That's a deal breaker.
Niord's toothy smile was as white as Scandinavian snow. I wished I knew his secret for staying so calm. Zen meditation? Fishing? Hotel Valhalla yoga classes?
Ah, Magnus,
You are so much like your father.
I blinked. We're both blonde and like the outdoors?
You both have kind hearts, said Njord.
Frey would do anything for a friend. He always loved easily and deeply, sometimes unwisely. You have the proof of that around your neck.
I curled my fingers around Jack's runestone. I knew the story. Frey had given up the Sword of Summer so he could win the love of a beautiful giantess. Because he had forsaken his weapon, he would be slain at Ragnarok. The moral of the story, as Jack liked to put it, blades before babes. The thing was, pretty much everybody would be slain at Ragnarok anyway. I didn't blame my dad for his choices. If he didn't fall in love easily, I would never have been born. Fine, I'm like my dad, I said. I still choose my friends over a cup of mead. I don't care if it's pumpkin spice or peach lambic.
It's blood, actually, Njord said. And God spit.
I started to feel seasick, and I didn't think it was because of the direction I was facing.
Come again?
Njord opened his hand. Above his palm floated the miniature glowing figure of a bearded man in woolen robes. His face was open and cheerful, his expression caught in mid-laugh. Seeing him, it was hard not to lean forward, smile, and want to hear what he was laughing about.
This was Kvasir.
Njord's tone took on an edge of sadness.
The most perfect being ever created. Millennia ago, when the Vanir and Aesir gods ended their war, all of us spit into a golden cup. From that mixture sprang Kvasir, our living peace treaty.
Suddenly, I didn't want to lean so close to the little glowing man. The dude was made of spit.
Makes sense, Blitzen grunted. God saliva is an excellent crafting ingredient.
Hearthstone tilted his head. He seemed fascinated by the holographic figure. He signed, "Why would anyone murder him?"
Murder? I asked.
Njord nodded, lightning flickering in his eyes. For the first time, I got the impression that my grandfather wasn't just some laid-back guy with nice feet. He was a powerful deity who could probably crumple our worship with a single thought.
Kvasir wandered the nine worlds, bringing wisdom, advice, and justice wherever he went. Everyone loved him. And then he was slaughtered. Horrible. Inexcusable.
Loki? I guessed, because that seemed like the logical next word in that list. Njord barked a short, sour laugh.
Not this time, no. It was dwarves.
He glanced at Blitzen.
No offense.
Blitzen shrugged.
Dwarves aren't all the same.
Like gods. If Njord sensed an insult, he didn't let on. He closed his hand and the tiny spit man disappeared.
The details of the murder aren't important. Afterward, Kvasir's blood was drained and mixed with honey to create a magical mead. It became the most prized, most coveted drink in the nine worlds.
Ugh. I put my hand to my mouth. My idea of which details should be left out of the story was very different from Njord's.
You want me to drink mead that is made from blood that is made from godspit?
Njord stroked his beard.
When you put it that way, it sounds bad. But yes, Magnus, whoever drinks Kvasir's mead finds their inner poet. The perfect words come to you. The poetry flows. The oration dazzles. The stories enthrall all who listen. With such power, you could stand toe to toe, insult to insult, in a flighting with Loki.
My mind pitched and swayed along with my stomach. Why did I have to be the one to challenge Loki? My inner voice responded, or maybe it was Jack. Because you volunteered at the feast, dummy. Everybody heard you. I rubbed my temples, wondering if it was possible for a brain to literally explode from too much information. That's one death I'd never experienced in Valhalla. Hearthstone stared at me with concern. You want a rune? He signed. Or some aspirin? I shook my head. So Uncle Randolph's notebook hadn't been a trick. He'd left an actual, viable plan for me to follow. In the end, despite all he'd done, it seemed like the old fool had experienced some remorse. He had tried to help me. I wasn't sure if that made me feel better or worse. What about the name Bulwark? I asked. Who is that? Njord smiled. That was Odin's alias. For a long time, the giants possessed all of Kvasir's mead. Odin went in disguise to steal some back for the gods. He succeeded. He even scattered drops of mead around Midgard to inspire mortal bards. But the gods' supply of the elixir was exhausted centuries ago. The only mead that remains is a tiny portion, jealously guarded by the giants. To get it, you will have to follow in Bulwark's footsteps and steal what only Odin was ever able to steal. Perfect, Blitz muttered. So how do we do that? More important, I said, why is it so dangerous for Hearth and Blitz? And how can we make it not be? I had an overwhelming desire to write a letter for Hearth and Blitz. Dear Cosmic Forces, please excuse my friends from their deadly fate. They are not feeling well today. At the very least, I wanted to outfit them with safety helmets, life jackets, and reflective decals before sending them off. Njord faced Hearthstone and Blitzen. He signed, "You already know your task." He made a stick figure man standing in his palm. Ground. Then two fists, one tapping the other. Work. Lay the groundwork. At least, I thought that's what he meant. Either that or you farm the fields. Since Njord was a god of crops, I couldn't be sure. Hearthstone touched his scarf. He signed, reluctantly, "The stone?" Njord nodded. "You know where you must look for it." Blitzen broke into the conversation, signing so fast his words got a little muddled. "Leave my elf alone. We can't do that again. Too dangerous." Or he could have meant, "Leave my elf in the bathroom. We can't do that wristwatch. Too much garbage." "What are you guys talking about?" I asked. My spoken words sounded jarring and unwelcome in the silent dialogue. Blitzen brushed his chainmail vest. "Our long-range reconnaissance work, kid. Mimir told us to look for the mead of Kvasir. Then we heard rumors about a certain item we'd need. Bulwark's whetstone," I guessed. He nodded unhappily. "It's the only way to defeat..." He spread his hands. "Whatever's guarding the mead. We're not clear on the who, how, or why." Those all seemed like pretty important points to me. "The thing is," Blitz continued, "if this stone is where we think it is..." "It's all right," Hearthstone signed. "We must. So we will." "Buddy, no," Blitz said. "You can't..."
"The elf is right," Njord said. "You two must find the stone while Magnus and the rest of the crew sail on to discover the location of the mead. Are you ready?"
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," I said. "You're sending them away right now? They just got here."
Grandson, you have very little time before Loki's ship is ready to sail. Only by dividing can you conquer.
I was pretty sure the old divide and conquer saying meant that the divided army got conquered. But Njord didn't sound like he was in the mood for a debate. Let me go instead. I staggered to my feet. I just had the longest day in the history of days. I was ready to fall over. But there was no way I was going to stand by while my two oldest friends got sent into mortal danger. Or at least let me go with them.
Kid, Blitz said, his voice cracking. It's okay.
My burden, Hearth signed, both hands pushing down on one of his shoulders. Njord gave me another calm smile. I was about ready to punch in my grandfather's perfect teeth.
The crew of this ship will need you with them, Magnus, he said. But I promise you this. Once Hearthstone and Blitzen have found the location of the whetstone, once they have laid the groundwork for the assault, I will send them back to get you. Then the three of you can face the true danger together. If you fail, you'll die as a team. How is that?
That didn't make me yell, hooray, but I figured it was the best offer I was going to get. All right. I helped Blitz to his feet and gave him a hug. He smelled like toasted kelp and dwarf noir eau de toilette. Don't you dare die without me.
Do my best, kid.
I faced Hearthstone. I put my hand gently on his chest, an elfish gesture of deep affection. You, I signed, safe. Or me, angry. The corners of his mouth pulled upward, though he still looked distracted and worried. His heartbeat fluttered under my fingertips like a scared dove. You too, he signed. Njord snapped his fingers, and my friends broke into sea spray, like waves crashing against the bow. I swallowed down my anger. I told myself Njord had only sent Hearth and Blitz away. He hadn't actually vaporized them. He'd promised I would see them again. I had to believe that. Now what? I asked him. What do I do while they're gone?
Ah.
Njord crossed his legs in lotus position, probably just to show off the soles of his wave-sculpted feet.
Your task is equally difficult, Magnus. You must discover the location of Kvasir's mead. This is a closely guarded secret, known only to a few giants. But there is one who might be convinced to tell you. Hrungnir, who prowls the human land of Jorvik.
The ship hit a swell, jarring my stomach loose from its undercarriage. I've had some bad encounters with giants.
Haven't we all? Njord said. Once you reach Jorvik, you must find Hrungnir and challenge him. If you beat him, demand that he give you the information you need.
I shuddered, thinking about the last time I was in Jotunheim. Please tell me this challenge won't be a bowling tournament.
Oh no, rest easy, Njord said. It will most likely be personal combat to the death. You should bring a couple of friends along. I would recommend the attractive one, Alex Fierro.
I wondered if Alex would be flattered by that, or grossed out, or if she'd just laugh. I wondered if Alex's feet were as well-groomed as Njord's. What a stupid thing to wonder about. Okay, I said. Jorvik. Wherever that is.
Your ship knows the way, Njord promised. I can grant you safe passage that far, but if you survive and sail onward, your ship will once again be vulnerable to attack by Aegir, Ran, their daughters, or worse things.
I will try to contain my happiness.
That's wise,
Niord said. Your elf and dwarf will find the whetstone you require. You will discover the secret location of the mead. Then you will retrieve the mead of Kvasir, defeat Loki, and return him to his chains.
I appreciate the vote of confidence.
Well, it's more that if you don't, Loki will flight you into a pathetic, powerless shadow of yourself. Then you will have to watch all your friends die, one by one, until you alone are left to suffer in Helheim for eternity while the nine worlds burn. That is Loki's plan.
Oh.
Anyway, Njord said brightly. Good luck!
My grandfather exploded in a fine sea mist, splattering my face with salt. Chapter 14. Nothing happens. It's a miracle. Smooth sailing. I never appreciated that term until I'd actually had some. The next 2 days were shockingly, perversely uneventful. The sky remained cloudless, the winds gentle and cool. The sea stretched in all directions like green silk, reminding me of pictures my mom used to show me from her favorite artist, this dude named Christo, who worked outside and wrapped entire forests, buildings, and islands in shimmering cloth. It looked like Christo had turned the North Atlantic into one huge art installation. The Big Banana sailed merrily onward. Our yellow oars churned by themselves. The sail tacked and jibed as needed. When I told the crew we were going to Jorvik, Halfborn grunted unhappily. But whatever he knew about the place, he wouldn't share. At least the ship seemed to understand where we were heading. The second afternoon, I found myself standing amidships with Mallory Keene, who'd been acting even more disgruntled than usual.
I still don't understand why Blitzenhearth had to leave, she grumbled.
I had a sneaking suspicion Miss Keene had a crush on Blitzen, but I was not brave enough to ask. Every time Blitz visited Valhalla, I would catch Mallory checking out his immaculate beard and perfect outfit, then glancing at Halfborn Gunderson as if wondering why her boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, re-boyfriend, ex-boyfriend couldn't dress so nattily. Njord swore it was necessary, I said, though I'd been doing little else but worrying about Blitzenhearth. Something about maximizing our time.
Humph.
Mallory waved at the horizon.
Yet here we are, sailing and sailing. Your grandpa couldn't have just zapped us to Jorvik. That would have been more useful.
Halfborn Gunderson walked by with a mop and bucket.
Useful, he muttered. Unlike some people.
Shut up and swab, Mallory snapped. As for you, Magnus, I warned you about taking Loki's bait. And what did you do? Stepped up and volunteered for a flighting. You're as stupid as this berserker.
With that, she climbed to the top of the mast, the most solitary place on the ship, and proceeded to glare daggers at the ocean. Halfborn mumbled as he swabbed the deck.
Red-headed Irish vixen. Pay her no mind, Magnus.
I wished we didn't have to make our voyage while the two of them were feuding. Or while Sam was fasting for Ramadan. Or while Alex was trying to teach Sam how to foil Loki's control. Come to think of it, I wished we didn't have to make this voyage at all. What's Mallory's history with Loki? I asked. She seems... I wasn't sure which word to use. Worried? Resentful? Homicidal? Halfborn nodded his shoulders, making the serpent tattoos undulate across his back. He glanced at the top of the mast, as if considering more curse words at Mallory's expense.
Not my place to say, but being baited into doing something you later regret, Mallory knows about that. It's how she died.
I thought back to my first days in Valhalla, when Halfborn had teased Mallory for trying to disarm a car bomb with her face. Her death must have had more to it. She'd been brave enough to attract the attention of a Valkyrie.
Magnus, you've got to understand, Halfborn said. We're both heading toward the places where we died. It may be different for you. You died in Boston, stayed in Boston. You haven't been dead long enough to see the world change around you. But for us, Mallory's got no wish to see Ireland again, even if we just sail past its shores. And me, I never wanted to return to Jorvik.
I felt a pang of guilt. Man, I'm sorry. Is that where you died?
Not the exact spot, but close. I helped conquer the city with Ivar the Boneless. It served as our base camp. Not much of a town back in the day. I just hope they don't still have Vatnavatir in the river.
He shuddered.
Bad.
I had no idea what Vatnavatir were. But if Halfborn Gunderson considered them bad, I did not want to meet them. Later that evening, I checked in on TJ, who was standing at the prow, staring over the waves, drinking coffee, and nibbling a piece of hardtack. Why he liked hardtack, I couldn't tell you. It was like a big saltine cracker made with cement instead of flour, and no salt. Hey, I said. He had trouble focusing on me.
Oh, hey, Magnus.
He offered me a cement cracker. Want one? I'm good, thanks. I might need my teeth later on. He nodded as if he hadn't gotten the joke. Ever since I'd told the crew about my conversation with Njord, TJ had been quiet and withdrawn, about as close as he ever got to brooding. He dipped his hardtack in the coffee. I've always wanted to go to England. I just never thought it would be after I was dead, on a quest, on a bright yellow warship. England? That's where we're heading. Didn't you know? When I thought about England, which wasn't very often, I thought of the Beatles, Mary Poppins, and guys wearing bowler hats, carrying umbrellas, and saying, "Pip, pip, cheerio." I didn't think about hordes of Vikings or places called Jorvik. Then I remembered that when I first met Halfborn Gunderson, he told me he died invading East Anglia. That had been a kingdom in England like 1,200 years ago. Those Vikings really got around. TJ leaned on the rail. In the moonlight, a thin streak of amber glowed across his neck, the path of a minié ball that had grazed him during his first battle as a Union Army soldier. It seemed strange to me that you could die, reach Valhalla, get resurrected daily for 150 years, and still carry a tiny scar you got in your mortal life. Back in the war, he said, we all worried that Great Britain would declare for the rebels. The British had abolished slavery way before we did. The Union, I mean. But they needed southern cotton for their textile mills. The fact that the UK stayed neutral and didn't side with the South, that was a huge factor in the North winning the war. It always gave me a warm feeling toward the Brits. I dreamed about going there someday and saying thank you in person. I tried to detect sarcasm or irony in his tone. TJ was the son of a freed slave. He'd fought and died for a country that kept his family in chains for generations. He even carried the name of a famous slaveholder. But TJ said we when he talked about the Union. He wore his uniform proudly after more than a century. He dreamed about crossing the ocean to thank the British just because they'd done him the favor of staying neutral. How do you always find the bright side? I marveled. You're so positive. TJ laughed, nearly choking on his hardtack. Magnus, buddy, if you'd seen me right after I got to Valhalla, nah. Those first few years were rough. Union soldiers weren't the only ones who made it to Valhalla.
Plenty of rebels died with swords in their hands. Valkyries don't care which side of the war you fight on, or how just your cause is. They look for personal bravery and honor. There, just a hint of disapproval in his voice. First couple of years I was in Inheriye, I saw some familiar faces come through the feast hall. How did you die? I asked. The real story. He traced the rim of his cup. Told you. Charging the battlements at Fort Wagner, South Carolina. There's more to it. A few days ago, you warned me about accepting challenges. You talked like you had personal experience. I studied the line of TJ's jaw, the tension bottled up there. Maybe that was why he liked hardtack. It gave him something difficult to grind his teeth against. A Confederate lieutenant singled me out, he said at last. I have no idea why. Our regiment was hunkered down, waiting for the order to charge the battlements. The enemy fire was withering. None of us could move. He glanced over. And then this Reb officer stood up on the enemy lines. He pointed across no man's land with his sword, right at me, like somehow he knew me. He shouted, Well, you can guess what he called me. Come out and fight me, man to man! Which would have been suicide. I prefer to think of it as a hopeless display of bravery. You mean you did it? His coffee cup trembled between his hands. The piece of hardtack in it started to dissolve, expanding like a sponge, brown liquid soaking into the white starch. When you're a child of Tyr, he said, you can't turn down a personal duel. Somebody says, fight me, and you do it. Every muscle in my body responded to that challenge. Believe me, I didn't want to go one-on-one with that guy. He'd obviously been thinking of a word other than guy. But I couldn't refuse. I went over the top, charged the Reb fortifications all by myself. I heard later, after I was dead, that my action triggered the offensive that led to the fall of Fort Wagner. The rest of the fellows followed my example. Guess they figured I was so crazy, they'd better back me up. Me, I just wanted to kill that lieutenant. I did, too. Geoffrey Toussaint. Shot him once in the chest, then got close enough to jab my bayonet right into his gut. Of course, by then, the Rebs had shot me about 30 times. I fell in their ranks, and died smiling up at a bunch of angry Confederate faces. Next thing I knew, I was in Valhalla. Odin's undies, I muttered, which was a curse I saved for special occasions. Wait, the lieutenant you killed? How did you learn his name? TJ gave me a rueful smile. Finally, I understood. He ended up in Valhalla, too. TJ nodded. Floor 76. Me and old Geoffrey. We spent about 50 years killing each other over and over again every day. I was so filled with hate. That man was everything I despised, and vice versa. I was afraid we'd end up like Hunding and Helgi. Immortal enemies, still sniping at each other thousands of years later. But you didn't? Funny thing. Eventually, I just got tired of it. I stopped looking for Geoffrey Toussaint on the battlefield. I figured something out. You can't hold on to hate forever. It won't do a thing to the person you hate, but it'll poison you, sure enough. He traced the mini-A-ball scar with his finger. As for Geoffrey, he stopped showing up in the feast hall. Never saw him again. That happened to a lot of the Confederate and Harriar. They didn't last. They locked themselves in their rooms, never came out. They faded away. TJ shrugged and continued. I guess it was harder for them to adjust. You think the world is one way, then you find out it's much bigger and stranger than you ever imagined. If you can't expand your thinking, you're not going to do well in the afterlife. I recalled standing with Amir Fadlan on the rooftop of the Sitgo building, cradling his head and willing his mortal mind not to fracture under the weight of seeing the Bifrost Bridge and the Nine Worlds. Yeah, I agreed. Expanding your brain hurts. TJ smiled, but I no longer thought of it as an easy smile. It was hard won, as courageous as a solitary soldier charging enemy lines. You've accepted your own personal challenge now, Magnus. You're going to have to face Loki one-on-one. There's no going back. But if it helps, you won't be charging those fortifications by yourself. We'll be right there with you. He patted my shoulder. Now, if you'll excuse me. He handed me his coffee and hardtack soup like this was a fantastic gift. I'm off to get some shut-eye. Most of the crew slept below decks. The Big Banana, we had discovered, would unfold as many rooms as we needed to be comfortable, regardless of the exterior size of the hull. I wasn't sure how that worked. Even though I was a Doctor Who fan, I didn't feel like testing the limits of our bright yellow TARDIS. I preferred sleeping on the deck, under the stars, which is where I was on our third morning at sea, when Alex shook me awake.
"Let's go, Chase," she announced. "We're running Samira through her paces. I'm going to teach her how to defy Loki even if it kills us. And by us, I mean you."
Chapter 15. Monkey. I saw my problem immediately. I should never have introduced Alex to Percy Jackson. She had learned way too much from his relentless training methods. Maybe Alex couldn't summon sea animals, but she could turn into them. That was just as bad. We started with Samira and Alex fighting each other, on the deck, in the water, in the air. My job was to call out random animals from a stack of flashcards Alex had made. I'd shout, "Monkey!" And Sam was supposed to turn into a monkey mid-combat, while Alex shapeshifted continually from human to animal to human, doing her best to beat up Sam. Whenever Alex was in human form, she tossed out taunts like, "Come on, Al Abbas, you call that a cotton-topped tamarin? Do better!" After an hour of combat charades, Samira's face gleamed with sweat. She'd taken off her hijab and tied back her long brown hair so she could fight better. She considered us all family, so she had no problem going hijabless when required. She leaned against the rail, taking a breather. I almost offered her some water. Then I remembered she was fasting. "Maybe we should take a break until tonight," I suggested. "After dark, you can eat and drink. This must be killing you."
"I'm fine."
Sam wasn't a very good liar, but she forced a smile.
"Thanks, though."
Alex paced the deck, consulting her clipboard. A clipboard, y'all. Like she was gunning to be assistant manager at the Hotel Valhalla. She wore green skinny jeans with a pink tank top, the front stitched with an inappropriate hand gesture in glittery sequins. Her hair had started to grow out, the black roots making her look even more imposing, like a lion with a healthy mane.
"Okay, Magnus, your turn," she told me. "Get Jack and prepare to fight."
Jack was pleased to help.
"Combat time? Cool!"
He floated in a circle around me.
"Who are we fighting?"
"Sam," I said. Jack froze.
"But I like Sam."
"We're just practicing," I said. "Try to kill her without really killing her."
"Oh, phew. Okay, I can do that."
Alex had a clicker. Her cruelty knew no bounds. Jack and I double-teamed Sam. Jack attacking with his blade, obviously. Me with a mop handle.
which I doubt struck terror into Sam's heart. Sam dodged and weaved and tried to land hits on us with her axe, the blade wrapped in sail canvas. Sam was supposed to shapeshift whenever Alex clicked her clicker, which she did at random intervals with no regard for Sam's situation. The idea, I guessed, was to condition Samira to change shape whenever, wherever she had to, without second-guessing herself. Jack held back, I could tell. He only whacked Sam a couple of times. Me? I was less than successful with my mop. Combat maneuvering on the deck of a Viking ship turned out to be one of the many important skills I did not have. I tripped over the oars. I got snagged in the rigging. Twice, I bonked my head on the mast and fell into the ocean. About average for me, in other words. Sam had no such trouble. She left me bruised and battered. The only time I landed a hit was when Alex clicked at a particularly bad time. Mid-lunge, Sam turned into a parrot and flew beak-first into my mop handle. She squawked, turned back into a human, and sat down hard on the deck, a cloud of blue and red feathers fluttering around her. "Sorry, Sam," I felt mortified. "I've never hit a parrot before." Despite her bloody nose, she laughed.
"It's fine. Let's try that again."
We fought until we were both spent. Alex called our practice done, and the three of us slumped against the rail shields.
"Woo!" Jack propped himself next to me. "I'm exhausted."
Since all the energy he expended would come out of me as soon as I took hold of him, I decided to let Jack stay in blade form a while longer. I wasn't ready to go comatose until after I had lunch. But at least I could have lunch. I glanced at Samira. "This Ramadan thing, I seriously don't know how you do it." She raised an eyebrow.
"You mean why I do it?"
"That too. You really have to endure the fast for a whole month?"
"Yes, Magnus," she said. "It may surprise you to learn that the month of Ramadan lasts 1 month."
"Glad you haven't completely lost your snark." She dabbed her face with a towel, which was apparently not forbidden.
"I'm more than halfway through the month. It's not so bad."
She frowned.
"Of course, if we all die before the end of Ramadan, that would be irritating."
"Yeah," Alex agreed. "Loki burns down the 9 worlds while you're fasting, and you can't even have a drink of water? Ouch." Sam swatted her arm.
"You have to admit, Fiero, I was more focused today. Ramadan helps."
Maybe, Alex said. "I still think you're crazy to fast, but I'm not as worried as I was."
"I feel clearer," Sam said. "Emptier, in a good way. I'm not freezing up as much. I'll be ready when I face Loki, inshallah."
Sam didn't use that term much, but I knew it meant God willing. Though it obviously helped her, it never inspired much confidence in me. "I'm going to do great, inshallah," was sort of like saying, "I'm going to do great, assuming I don't get run over by a truck first." "Well," Alex said, "we won't know what'll happen until you're facing dear old mom/dad. But I'm cautiously optimistic. And you didn't kill Magnus, which I suppose is good." "Thanks," I muttered. Even that little bit of consideration from Alex, the idea that my death might be slightly disagreeable to her, gave me a warm and fuzzy feeling. Yeesh. I was pathetic. The rest of the afternoon, I helped out around the Big Banana. Despite the automatic sailing, there was still plenty to do. Swapping decks, untangling lines, preventing Mallory and Halfborn from killing each other. The chores kept me from thinking too much about my impending confrontation with Loki, or what Blitz and Hearth might be up to. They'd already been gone 3 days, and we now had just under 2 weeks until Midsummer,
maybe even less time until the ice melted enough to let Loki's ship sail. How long could it take Blitz and Hearth to find a rock? Naturally, the idea of searching for a whetstone brought back bad memories of my last quest with Blitz and Hearth, when we'd been trying to find the Skofnung stone. I told myself there was no connection. This time there would be no brutal Alfheim sunlight, no evil violin-playing Nox, no scowling, sadistic elf father. Soon, Hearth and Blitz would come back and report on a completely different set of dangerous obstacles for us to overcome. Every time a wave broke over the bow, I watched the sea spray, hoping it would solidify into my friends. But they did not reappear. A couple of times during the afternoon, small sea serpents swam by, like 20-footers. They eyed the ship, but didn't attack. I guessed they either didn't like banana-flavored prey, or were scared off by Jack singing. Jack followed me around the deck, alternating between ABBA hits, Vikings are huge ABBA fans, and telling me stories about the old days when he and Frey would roam the Nine Worlds, spreading sunshine and happiness, and occasionally killing people. As the day wore on, this became a personal test of endurance. Did I want to return Jack to Runestone form and pass out from the toll of our combined exertions? Or did I want to listen to him sing some more? Finally, around sunset, I couldn't stand it any longer. I stumbled aft to where I'd set up my sleeping bag. I lay down, enjoying the sound of Samira doing her evening prayer on the foredeck, the sing-song poetry soft and relaxing. It seemed strange, the Muslim Maghrib prayer aboard a Viking ship full of atheists and pagans. Then again, Samira's ancestors had been dealing with Vikings since the Middle Ages. I doubted this was the first time prayers to Allah had been said aboard a longship. The worlds were a lot more interesting because of constant intermixing. I returned Jack to Runestone form, and barely had time to reattach him to my neck chain before I passed out. In my dreams, I got to witness a murder. Chapter 16. Spitman versus Chainsaw. Guess who wins? I stood with four gods at the crest of a hill, next to the ruins of a thatched hut. Odin leaned on a thick oaken staff, chainmail glinting under his blue travel cloak. A spear was strapped across his back, a sword hung at his side. His one good eye gleamed under the shade of his blue, wide-brimmed hat. With his grizzled beard, eye patch, and assorted weapons, he looked like a guy who couldn't decide whether to go to a Halloween party as a wizard or a pirate. Next to him stood Heimdall, the guardian of the Bifrost Bridge. Smartphones must not have been invented yet, because he wasn't doing his usual thing of taking pictures every 5 seconds. He was dressed in armor of thick white wool, with two swords sheathed in an X across his back. Gialar, the Horn of Doomsday, dangled from his belt, which didn't strike me as very safe. Anybody could have run up behind him, blown that horn, and started Ragnarok as a practical joke. The third god, my father, Frey, knelt next to the ashes of a campfire. He wore faded jeans and a flannel shirt, though I didn't see how those clothes could have been invented yet. Maybe Frey was a medieval beta tester for REI. His blonde hair swept across his shoulders. His bristly beard glowed in the sunlight. If there had been any justice in the world, the thunder god Thor would have looked like this. Blonde and handsome and regal. Not like a muscle-bound red-headed fart machine. The fourth god I had never met, but I recognized him from Njord's holographic show-and-tell. Kvasir, the living peace treaty between Aesir and Vanir. He was a handsome guy, considering that he originated as a cup of divine spit. His dark, curly hair and beard rippled in the breeze. Homespun robes enfolded him, giving him that Jedi Master vibe. He knelt next to my father, his fingers hovering over the charred remnants of the campfire. Odin leaned toward him.
What do you think, Kvasir?
That question alone told me how much the gods respected Kvasir. Normally, Odin did not ask for the opinions of others. He simply gave answers, usually in the form of riddles or PowerPoint presentations. Kvasir touched the ashes.
This is Loki's fire, all right. He was here recently. He is still close by.
Heimdall scanned the horizon.
I don't see him anywhere in a 500-mile radius, unless... No, that's an Irishman with a nice haircut.
We must catch Loki, Odin grumbled. That flighting was the last straw. He must be imprisoned and punished. A net,
Kvasir announced. Frey scowled.
What do you mean?
See? Loki was burning the evidence.
Kvasir traced a barely discernible pattern of crossed lines in the ashes.
He was trying to anticipate our moves, considering all the ways we might capture him. He wove a net, then quickly burned it.
Kvasir rose.
Gentlemen, Loki has disguised himself as a fish. We need a net.
The others looked amazed. Like, Holmes, how did you do that? I waited for Kvasir to cry, the game's afoot. Instead, he shouted, to the nearest river, and strode off, the other gods hurrying after him. My dream changed. I saw flashes of Kvasir's life as he traveled the nine worlds, advising the locals on everything from farming to childbirth to tax deductions. All mortal beings loved him. In every town, castle, and village, he was greeted like a hero. Then one day, after filling out some particularly difficult tax forms for a family of giants, he was on the road to Midgard when he was stopped by a pair of dwarves, stunted, warty, hairy little guys with malicious smiles. Unfortunately, I recognized them, the brothers Fjallar and Gjallar. They'd once sold me a one-way boat ride. According to Blitzen, they were also notorious thieves and murderers.
Hello!
Fjallar called to Kvasir from the top of a boulder.
You must be the famous Kvasir!
Next to him, Gjallar waved enthusiastically.
Well met! We've heard wonderful things about you.
Kvasir, being the wisest being ever created, should have known enough to say, sorry, I gave it the office, and keep walking. Unfortunately, Kvasir was also kind. He raised his hand in greeting.
Hello, good dwarves. I am indeed Kvasir. How may I help you?
Fjallar and Gjallar exchanged glances, like they couldn't believe their good luck.
Well, you can be our guest for dinner.
Gjallar gestured to a nearby hillside, where the entrance to a cave was covered with curtains of ragged leather.
We are not interested in murdering you, Fjallar promised, or stealing your stuff, or draining your blood, which probably has incredible magical properties. We simply want to show you our hospitality.
Much appreciated, Kvasir said. But I am expected in Midgard tonight. Many humans need my help.
Oh, I see, Fjallar said. You like helping people.
He said it the way one might say, you like raw beef.
Well, as it happens, we're having a terrible time with our, quarterly estimated taxes.
Kvasir frowned in sympathy.
I see. Those can be difficult to calculate.
Yes!
Gjallar clasped his hands.
Could you help us, oh wise one?
This was like the part in every horror movie when the audience yells, don't do it! but Kvasir's compassion overcame his wisdom. "Very well," he said. "Show me your paperwork." He followed the dwarves into their cave. I wanted to run after him, to warn him what was going to happen, but my feet remained rooted to the ground. Inside the cave, Kvasir began to scream. A few moments later, I heard a sound like a chainsaw, then liquid gurgling into a large cauldron. If I'd been able to throw up in my sleep, I would have. The scene shifted one last time. I found myself in the front yard of a 3-story mansion, one in a line of colonials facing a public green. It might have been Salem or Lexington, one of those sleepy pre-revolutionary towns outside Boston. White-painted columns flanked the house's entrance. Honeysuckle bushes filled the air with sugary perfume. An American flag fluttered on the porch. The scene was so bucolic it could have been Alfheim if the sunlight had been a little harsher. The front door swung open, and a skinny figure tumbled down the brick steps as if she'd been thrown. Alex Fierro looked about 14, maybe 2 or 3 years younger than when I'd met her. A trickle of blood ran from her left temple. She crawled down the front walk on her hands and knees, her palms shredded from breaking her fall and leaving dabs of blood across the cement like a sponge painting. She didn't look scared so much as bitter and angry, with tears of frustration in her eyes. In the doorway of the house, a middle-aged man appeared, short dark hair streaked with gray, pressed black slacks, shiny black shoes, a white dress shirt so crisp and bright it hurt my eyes. I could imagine Blitzen saying, "You really need a splash of color, sir." The man had Alex's petite build. His face was handsome in the same harsh, angular way, like a diamond you could admire but not touch without getting cut. He shouldn't have been scary. He wasn't big or strong or tough-looking. He dressed like a banker. But there was something terrifying about the set of his jaw, the intensity of his stare, the way his lips twitched and tightened across his teeth as if he hadn't quite mastered human expressions. I wanted to put myself between him and Alex, but I couldn't move. In one hand, the man hefted a ceramic object the size of a football, a brown and white ovoid. I saw that it was a bust with 2 different faces side by side. "Normal!" The man threw the ceramic sculpture at Alex. It shattered on the walkway. "That's all I want from you, to be a normal kid. Is that so damn hard?" Alex struggled to her feet. She turned to face her father. A mauve skirt hung to her knees over black leggings. Her green sleeveless top had given her arms no protection from the pavement. Her elbows looked like they'd been struck by a meat tenderizer. Her hair was longer than I'd ever seen it, a green ponytail sprouting from her black roots like a flame from Aegir's hearth fire. "I am normal, father." She hissed the word as if it was the most twisted insult she could think of. "No more help." His tone was hard and cold. "No more money." "I don't want your money." "Well, that's good, because it's going to my real children." He spat on the steps. "You had so much potential. You understood the craft almost as well as your grandfather. And look at you."
"The art," Alex corrected.
"What?"
"It's art, not craft."
Her father waved in disgust at the broken ceramic pieces. "That is not art. It's trash." The sentiment was clear, even if he didn't say it. "You have chosen to be trash, too." Alex glared at her father. The air between them turned dry and bitter. Both seemed to be waiting for the other to make a definitive gesture, to apologize and give in, or to cut the thread between them forever. Alex got no such resolution. Her father shook his head in dismay, as if he couldn't believe his life had come to this. Then he turned and went inside, slamming the door behind him. I woke with a start.
What?
Relax, sleepy. Alex Fierro stood over me. Today's Alex, wearing a raincoat of such bright yellow, I wondered if our ship had begun to assimilate her. The banging sound I'd heard in my dream had been her dropping a full canteen next to my head. She lobbed an apple at my chest.
Breakfast, she said. And also lunch.
I rubbed my eyes. I could still hear the voice of her father and smell the honeysuckle in their front yard. How long was I out?
About 16 hours, she said. You didn't miss much, so we let you sleep. But now it's time.
For what? I sat up in my sleeping bag. My friends moved around the deck, tying off lines and securing the oars. Cold drizzle hung in the air. Our longship was moored at a stone embankment, on a river lined with brick townhouses not too different than those back home in Boston.
Welcome to Jorvik, Halfborn glowered. Or as you modern folk call it, York, England.
Chapter 17. We are ambushed by a pile of rocks. In case you're wondering, Old York looks absolutely nothing like New York. It looks older. Magnus Chase, Master of Description. You're welcome. Halfborn wasn't thrilled to be back at his old base camp.
No self-respecting Viking city should be so far from the sea, he grumbled. I don't know why Ivar the Boneless even bothered with this place. We wasted all morning sailing here. About 25 miles up the River Ouse.
The River Ouse? I asked. Ouse, TJ corrected, breaking into a grin. It rhymes with moose. I read about it in a travel guide. I shuddered. Nothing good rhymes with moose. Excuse, noose, caboose. I also found it disturbing that TJ had done so much research on England. Then again, 150 years is a long time to hang around Valhalla, and the hotel library is impressive. I glanced over the port side. Murky green water curled and swelled around our hull, the rain stippling the surface of the river with overlapping bullseyes. The current seemed too alive, too awake. No matter how much Percy Jackson had trained me, I did not want to fall in there.
You sense them, don't you?
Halfborn gripped his axe as if ready to cut loose on the ooze.
The Vatn of Atir.
Halfborn said the word as if he found it truly awful, like cowardice or beard trimmer. What are they? I asked. And do they have a more pronounceable name? Alex added.
They're nature spirits, Mallory said. We have similar legends in Ireland. We call them Ach Ishka, water horses.
Halfborn snorted.
You Irish have similar legends because you got them from the Norse.
Lies, Mallory growled. The Celts were in Ireland long before you louts invaded.
Louts? The Viking kingdom of Dublin was the only power worth mentioning on your miserable island.
Anyway,
Samira stepped between the two lovebirds.
Why are these water horses dangerous?
Halfborn frowned.
Well, they can form a herd, and if they get riled up, stampede and destroy our ship. I imagine they've only held off this long because they're not sure what to make of us being bright yellow. Also, if anyone is foolish enough to touch them,
they'll adhere to your skin, Mallory said. Drag you under and drown you.
Her words made my stomach clench. I'd once gotten myself adhered to a magical eagle that proceeded to take me on a demolition derby tour over the rooftops of Boston.
The idea of being dragged into the ooze sounded even less fun. Alex threw her arms around Mallory and Halfborn.
Well then, it sounds like you two are the water horse experts. You should stay on board and defend the big banana while the rest of us go giant hunting.
I said. I can just turn the ship into a handkerchief.
Oh no, Halfborn said. I have no desire to set foot in Jorvik again. I wouldn't be of any use to you anyway. Place has changed a bit in 1,200 years. I'll stay on the ship, but I don't need Mallory's help defending it.
You think not?
Mallory glared up at him, her hands on the hilts of her knives.
Do you know any Gaelic songs for calming the water horses? I'm not leaving this ship in your care.
Well, I'm not leaving it in your care.
Guys!
Samira raised her hands like a boxing referee. She'd never been much of a curser, but I got the sense she was struggling with the Ramadan no-cursing rule again. Funny how that works. As soon as you're told you can't do something, you have the overwhelming desire to do it.
If you both insist on staying aboard, she said, I'll stay too. I'm good with horses. I can fly if I get in trouble. And in a pinch,
she flicked her wrist, telescoping her spear of light into existence.
I can blast anything that attacks us. Or I can blast the two of you if you don't behave.
Halfborn and Mallory looked equally unhappy about that arrangement, which meant it was a good compromise.
You heard the lady, Alex said. The landing party will consist of me, TJ, and blonde guy.
Excellent. TJ rubbed his hands. I can't wait to thank the British. TJ wasn't kidding. As we walked the narrow streets of York in a cold gray drizzle, he greeted everyone he saw and tried to shake hands.
Hello, he said. I'm from Boston. Thank you for not supporting the Confederacy.
The reactions of the locals ranged from, eh, to leave off, to some phrases so colorful I wondered if the speakers had descended from Halfborn Gunderson. TJ wasn't deterred. He strolled along, waving and pointing.
Anything you guys need, he offered. I owe you.
He grinned at me. I love this place. The people are so friendly. I scanned the low rooftops, figuring that if there was a giant in this city, I should be able to spot him.
So, if you were a Jotun in York, where would you be hiding?
Alex stopped in front of a collection of street signs. With her green hair sticking out the hood of her yellow raincoat, she looked like a punk spokesperson for frozen fish sticks.
Maybe we could start there.
She pointed at the top sign.
The Jorvik Viking Center.
It sounded like as good a plan as any, especially since we had no other plans. We followed the signs, winding our way through narrow, crooked streets lined with brick townhouses, pubs, and storefronts. It could have been the north end of Boston, except York was even more of a historical patchwork. Victorian brick butted up against medieval stone, which butted up against black-and-white Elizabethan magpie, which butted up against a tanning salon offering 20 minutes for £5. We passed only a few people. Traffic was light. I wondered if it was a holiday, or if the locals had heard about the bright yellow Viking ship invading the Ouse and had run for the hills. I decided it was just as well. If there had been more English folk to meet and greet, TJ would have really slowed us down. We made our way down a street called the Shambles, which struck me as an honest description, but poor branding. The road itself was just wide enough for a bicycle, assuming the rider was skinny. The houses overhung the sidewalk at funhouse mirror angles, each story a little wider than the one below it, giving the impression that the entire neighborhood would collapse in on itself if we took one wrong step. I barely breathed until we emerged onto a wider avenue. Finally, the signs led us to a pedestrian shopping area,
where a squat brick building was festooned with green banners. Vikings, living history, thrills, full interactive experience. All of which sounded pretty good. Except for the sign across the front entrance. Closed.
Huh.
TJ rattled the door handle. Should we break in? I didn't see what good that would do. The place was obviously a museum for tourists. No matter how good this interactive experience was, it would be a letdown after actually living in Valhalla. I didn't need any Viking paraphernalia from the gift shop either. My runestone pendant, talking sword, was as much as I could handle. Guys? Alex said, her voice tight. Did that wall just move? I followed her gaze. Across the pedestrian plaza, jutting from the side of a Tesco Express grocery store, was a crumbling section of rough-hewn limestone blocks that might have been part of a castle or the old city walls. At least that's what I thought.